Thank you, Barbara. And thank you, Larry, for that introduction. And yes, Barbara described our civil society in the 1700s and 1800s up to Alexis de Tocqueville. I want to pick it up and talk about the 1800s and into the 1900s. De Tocqueville is a good place to launch off. Here's another statement by de Tocqueville that many of you are familiar with. Americans of all ages, all conditions, and all dispositions constantly form associations. They have not only commercial and manufacturing companies in which to take part, but associations of a thousand other kinds. The Americans make associations to give entertainments, to found seminaries, to build inns, to construct churches, to diffuse books, to send missionaries to the Antipodes. In this manner, they found hospitals, prisons, and schools. If it is proposed to inculcate some truth or to foster some feeling by the encouragement of a great example, they form a society. Wherever, at the head of some new undertaking, you see the government in France, or a man of rank in England, in the United States, you will be sure to find an association. There you have, in the 1930s, the picture of civil society in operation in the United States. And that society was present, as Barbara described, in colonial times, and would remain present throughout, really, the 1800s, and in fact, into the first couple decades of the 1900s, that still would be an accurate description of American society. What I want to focus on here a little bit is the development of civil society, especially through entrepreneurs and their giving and their associations that they started. Because that was one of the functions that entrepreneurs believed they had, and roles, to create various associations to promote objects that they were interested in. Now, entrepreneurs always had a certain amount of conflict because some of the money the family wanted, descendants. Some of the money for the family business. But then there was starting these associations that were also objects of interest to entrepreneurs. I think we can divide these associations and this giving in the 1800s and early 1900s really into three categories. The first would be the one that Barbara has described so vividly, and that would be the welfare, one-on-one welfare. And you'll notice with many of the examples that Barbara gave, it's one-on-one. Somebody is down and out, and we have an association to deal with that person. When William Booth established the Salvation Army, and it came over here to the United States, that one-on-one was a special feature of the Salvation Army. In other words, we will work one-on-one to meet someone's bodily needs if they're hungry, but we will meet their spiritual needs as well as part of this Salvation Army. Churches, of course, were the main source of one-on-one giving. Because if you give to your church, then the church can meet needs in the community that poor people have one-on-one. Typically, the requirement is, come to church, right? And that way, we will meet your physical needs, and we will meet your spiritual needs as well. Also, with entrepreneurs, they could hire them for possibly the business they're running in some capacity. Henry Ford here in Michigan was legendary for giving jobs at Ford Motor Company to people who were kind of down and out who he thought might have a chance to be productive. He talks about one day he was driving into his shop at Dearborn, encountered one of these homeless types who was on the side of the road and had a sign that was sort of the equivalent of the "We'll work for food" sign. And so Ford asked him to hop in, took him right down to the factory, and gave him a job. And Ford describes one week later his surprise when he was driving down that same road to work and saw this fellow again on the side of the road. He says, "I thought I gave you a job." And he said, "I'd rather do this." It's sort of like the example Barbara gave of Cotton Mather. We will not necessarily support people in vices that they have. And so that person was no longer the object of any public support or any private support from Henry Ford. So welfare, one-on-one welfare, very important to the entrepreneurs, churches, the Salvation Army, later YMCAs, this sort of thing. The second would be direct Christian association. Not only one-on-one welfare, but direct Christian associations. I think of Anson Phelps here of New York, the founder of the Phelps Dodge Company, who helped found the American Bible Society. And here you're going to make Bibles to distribute both here in the United States and even abroad to help missionaries. So that goal of the American Bible Society, directly, in other words, Phelps accumulates capital. He's a Christian. He sees the need for outreach. His particular association, American Bible Society, and it reaches out both abroad and here in the United States. So you have Christian associations, welfare, and then the third category I would call human capital building. That is, entrepreneurs wanted to help establish human capital building, in other words, promoting the infrastructure of the United States. I would put into this category libraries, that is, public support for libraries, especially free libraries, which were developed in a large-scale way in the late 1800s. Libraries, hospitals, museums, art galleries, and colleges. There's also, as you might detect, sort of a symbiotic relationship between all three of these. Welfare, one-on-one, Christian associations, and colleges all sort of push sometimes in the same direction, promoting a Christian society, promoting virtue, promoting character. You look at the colleges, for example, since that's the area that probably most people here would be interested in. You have colleges set up to specifically promote character, virtue, high standards of excellence. And some of these are Christian colleges. Charles Finney was the head of Oberlin College in the mid-1800s, then a strong Christian college. And he drew support upon the Tappan family and others that were entrepreneurs in New York to help fund Oberlin in its particular mission, the connection here with entrepreneurs, in this case in Christian colleges. But it wasn't always Christian colleges. I think of the founder of Lehigh University, Asa Packer. He was a coal and railroad entrepreneur. He founded Lehigh University, and he also was the head of Bethlehem Steel. And he would train the engineers at Lehigh and then hire the good ones at Bethlehem Steel. And the others could go work for his competitors. But nonetheless, he was in the business of training people, and so he plowed a lot of his giving into establishing Lehigh University and then would hire the engineers from that place. We see this also with Max Eastman of Eastman Kodak, someone Larry Reed at the Mackinac Center has written on in one of the Mackinac Center viewpoints. Max Eastman hired people in his business, of course, the photography business, from MIT. That was an institution that he liked very much to hire people from. And he ended up giving money to MIT. He ended up giving, during his lifetime, about $20 million to MIT, and then would hire many MIT grads to work at Eastman Kodak. So you see that sometimes this relationship between giving to help start colleges and then receiving benefits from that. But nonetheless, we see entrepreneurs involved, one-on-one welfare, Christian associations, and human capital. Now, as I've indicated, there's kind of a tension that sometimes exists between the family members who would like that money and the voluntary association that is receiving it, the college or the church or whatever. But in studying this and in writing three books on the subject, I'm always amazed how often that the family seems to go along with the dream that the patriarch has in setting up some particular association or college. One of the better examples, I think, of this is the founder of Rice University, William Rice, in Houston, where Barbara and I work at the Center for Renewal and Center for the American Idea in Houston. William Rice exhibits some of this tension between the family getting the money and in this case, the college getting the money. William Rice was murdered 100 years ago this fall, an indication of some of the tension that took place in that family. He was a man in his 80s. He set up, he made his money in Houston and Texas in cotton, in banking, in real estate. Then he set up a will. His wife died, and he had no children, but he had lots of cousins and nephews who he was very fond of. And he set up a will, And in this will, he was going to give, he had about $6 million, which for 1900 is a substantial amount. He was going to give 90% to establish the institution Rice University. He had 10% for the cousins and the nephews. Now, into that picture came a man named Albert Patrick. Albert Patrick got in touch with Charles Jones, who was the man taking care of William Rice in his old age in New York. Rice lived in an apartment. Charles Jones was his valet and took care of his papers. Albert Patrick came up to him and said, "I've got an idea. Let's have a change of the will in a way that we would benefit." He said, "Let's give me the entire estate. We'll get his signature, because he's not looking at the papers you put before him. We'll leave a paper trail of alleged paperwork that we had going on months before. Then I will give roughly half of it to you, because you're going to be the one to find him dead and acknowledge that I, Albert Patrick, am the recipient of this estate." And here's the thing they did to seal it that they thought made it a sure thing. When they murdered William Rice, they never expected the problem that would result, because their strategy was, we will take every single one of those family members and triple and quadruple the amount they are in the new will for, the fraudulent will. So that when the funeral came, Albert Patrick was there to greet the cousins and nephews and said, "Oh, what a tragedy that William Rice has died. But you're in the new will for $90,000 instead of $30,000. The assumption being that they would naturally agree to the new will because their self-interest would be advanced. And then ultimately Albert Patrick and Charles Jones would walk off with the rest of it. Rice University would never be started. It's fascinating that every single one of those cousins and nephews contested the will, and that Albert Patrick ended up in jail in New York on a charge of murder and fraudulent will writing. And that those relatives ended up with much less than they would have had, and that Rice University was established. Tremendous commitment on the part of many people to see their founder's vision enacted, whether it's college, Christian association, whatever. Many of you know that the wealthiest two entrepreneurs of the late 1800s and early 1900s, John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie. Carnegie, you can see them fit the model of civil society very nicely. Here's a quotation from Andrew Carnegie. "The best means of benefiting the community is to place within its reach the ladders upon which the aspiring can rise. Free libraries, parks, and means of recreation by which men are helped in body and mind. Works of art and public institutions of various kinds, which will improve the general condition of the people. In this manner, returning their surplus wealth to the mass of their fellows in the forms best calculated to do them lasting good." And so we look at Carnegie's record, commonly known. He started, by himself almost 2,000 free public libraries in almost 1,500 small towns and cities throughout the United States. Part of the building of human capital that's part of civil society. John D. Rockefeller was the first billionaire in American history, had even more than Carnegie did. And Rockefeller, you can see some of the problems developing here around 1900. Rockefeller writes as follows: "I am in trouble." By the way, he's the first billionaire in American history. His troubles are those that many of us would like to have shared. But he starts this quotation, "I am in trouble. The pressure of these appeals for gifts has become too great for endurance. I haven't the time or strength with all of my heavy business responsibilities to deal with these demands properly. I am so constituted as to be unable to give away money with any satisfaction until I have made the most careful inquiry as to the worthiness of the cause. The investigations are now taking more of my time and energy than Standard Oil itself." You see the problem. So much money, so many causes. The previous generations, Anson Phelps, remember? He has $500,000. You start the American Bible Society. You print Bibles and you give it out. A specific cause, a specific amount of money to help fund it. What do you do when you have $1 billion? Well, Rockefeller, as you know, set up the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, this is a different breed of institution coming into civil society. The foundation. And I think it's very interesting that he turned over the operation of the Rockefeller Foundation to his son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., and then his grandson, John D. Rockefeller III, neither of which had any serious business experience in raising the money that they were now going to be giving away. And it's rather interesting that they set up as a goal of the Rockefeller Foundation, and I quote, "the betterment of mankind." Think about this and how different it is from the other institutions of civil society. The betterment of mankind. Very different from Lehigh University to train engineers. The betterment of mankind. And we're going to have layers of bureaucrats who will read proposals and help define exactly what the betterment of mankind is. For example, educational innovations are very much for the betterment of mankind. So we'll have programs for people to work on the new math and to work on whole language learning and this kind of thing. And we get the betterment of mankind. We're going to see the Carnegie Foundation come over, and it will also have this similar structure and begin to veer from the intentions of the founder, Andrew Carnegie. But we still have civil society in the early 1900s. What's going to happen? We're going to have the decline of civil society, the rise of political society, the New Deal being a period when we can really look at that transition in full thrust. Now, I think the best way to approach this is through looking at the income tax. That's one of the features of the rise of political society. Getting money so that the government can do these things instead of entrepreneurs and other people. We see the first income tax very small. A maximum of 7% was the top rate. And in fact, the only way you had to pay any income tax back in 1913 when the tax was passed was that if you earned an income that is the equivalent in today's dollars of $60,000. And then the rate started at 1%. Well, by the 1920s, we see it up to about 25, 24%. The Great Depression hits. Herbert Hoover, one of his bills that was supported widely was to increase the progressive income tax to a top rate of 63% on top incomes. We're talking here about over $500,000. Franklin Roosevelt came in and in 1935 raises the percentage through Democratic support in Congress to 79% on top income. He kicked off the first year of his third term by proposing a bill to tax all income over $100,000 at the rate of 99.5%. In other words, on that second $100,000, you would give to the government $99,500 and you would be allowed to keep $500. We always have some joker who comes in and thwarts these types of proposals. The one who says the emperor is wearing no clothes, this type of fellow, who came in, the congressman from Illinois, and said, "But wait a minute, my state has a 2% state income tax." And so Roosevelt had to abandon the 99.5 temporarily. In 1942, Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order, because this way you don't have to deal with Congress. Signed an executive order taxing all income over $25,000. That is, everybody who made income over $25,000, that income would be taxed at the rate of 100%. An executive order. Even films were promoted during World War II. When this was done, it was cited as an emergency measure, of course. David O. Selznick produced a film called Since You Went Away. I have not seen this film, I've only read about it, in which a wealthy man stands up and points and says at some point, a wealthy man, quote, "It suits me if they tax me 100%. Apparently not all the wealthy of the 1940s were quite as self-sacrificing as Roosevelt anticipated and as this man in the film was suggesting. Roosevelt had Congress repeal his 100%, but he did get a 90% income tax on large incomes. He did change the situation where the exemption was reduced to the point that 60% of Americans now had to pay income tax as opposed to 2% who had to pay when Roosevelt took office. This is creating a society taking in a lot of wealth in taxes, and a lot is going to be distributed as we move into political society. Once we get into the political society, we see the tax-exempt foundations increase dramatically because this is where entrepreneurs now put their wealth to escape the taxation. Roosevelt also instituted through Congress a 70% inheritance tax. What we see is Henry Ford immediately, with that 70% income tax, put the money in and began the Ford Foundation to escape the taxes. But these foundations are easy to control by others who are not of the same philosophical stripe as Henry Ford or Andrew Carnegie or John D. Rockefeller. It's interesting that when Roman Gaither headed the Ford Foundation, he said this, that he wanted to use the resources of the Ford Foundation to, quote, comfortably merge the United States and the Soviet Union. Henry Ford II, in dealing with this, Henry Ford II himself resigned from the board of directors of the Ford Foundation in 1977 because he said, quote, "The Ford Foundation is a creature of capitalism, but it is hard to discern recognition of this fact in anything that the Ford Foundation does." And so he resigned from the board. William Simon, formerly with the Olin Foundation, and there were some foundations resisting this trend. Olin was one, but the Pew Foundation, we have Earhart, Bradley, Lilly. There were others that were resisting this trend toward foundations and, I would say, the leftist dominance of foundations. But William Simon said, quote, "There is a new class of reformers seeking to reshape the future along collectivist lines. These are the foundations and their staffers." Wow, hard-hitting comment that Simon makes. But it illustrates the trend, and you can see some of this in modern giving. Ted Turner gives $1 billion to the United Nations for the betterment of mankind. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates giving to world population control. Movements very different from those of the entrepreneurs of the 1800s. And so what we have is civil society is not receiving a lot of this foundation money, it is going into those who favor other more leftist causes. When we also have, and this would be my last point, we have the development of political society, what's going to happen then when the government begins to take over the welfare functions, which used to be one-on-one through churches, through organizations that entrepreneurs and others established? I'd like to just look in finishing at the first federal welfare relief program. And you can see it in contrast with what Barbara has described and will be describing and what the entrepreneurs were doing that I've talked about with their civil society approach. The first bill was 1932. In the midst of the Great Depression, $300 million were allocated for federal relief. Now, we didn't have a bureaucratic apparatus that could easily distribute this money. The program was designed that the governors of each of the then 48 states would apply to Washington. Did they have people who were starving and needed direct relief? If so, they could apply for some of that $300 million. Think about that a minute. The governor will check with people in his state, leaders of cities, mayors, this sort of thing, and submit a request for money based on what they indicate is the need of the people of their state. Massachusetts, let's look at them for a moment. Massachusetts said, hey, we can meet our own needs. I know there's over 20% unemployment in the nation, but we'll have our own entrepreneurs give to soup kitchens. Back then, they had two Major League Baseball teams, the Braves and the Red Sox. We'll have exhibition games to raise money for charity to feed the people of Boston. We will do a variety of things. We request zero. We can do it. The state of Illinois had a different attitude. The government of Chicago was in a very corrupt state. Al Capone was on the loose, a variety of problems. They requested from the federal government $55 million of that $300 million and received it. Illinois gets $55 million, Massachusetts nothing. So in other words, Massachusetts is subsidizing through the taxes to raise that $300 million, partly subsidizing not only their own welfare, which they're having to produce one-on-one in the state of Massachusetts, but also Illinois for their own incompetence. I think it's significant that in the next 2 years, when another request for welfare came out under the same system, that the state of Massachusetts decided that it had dire needs and requested and received $112 million, more than twice as much as Illinois had received the first round. And it indicates for you the transition from civil society to political society, the problems that took place. Barbara has some ideas in this era in which political society seems to have superseded civil society. What options are possible?